unexamined life is not worth living.
If you compare those numbers of legally interviewing individuals to the cost of, let's say, sending troops to the border for months and months and months, I think the cost would be less.
This is Cross-Examined Life, the place where you're encouraged to ask more questions. The format is cross-exam, and the subject is chosen by the guest. Join us as we elevate the art of disagreement, unpack assumptions, and challenge beliefs, one question at a time.
Welcome to episode 39 of Cross-Examined Life, the pod that improves the way we disagree with one another. I'm your host, Chris Tatum, and you'll enjoy this episode if you like conversations about what it means to have national borders, whether humanitarian policies are useful for the U.S., and to whom humanitarian support should be given. Listeners have been saying the kindest things about Cross-Examine Life recently. Just the other day, I got a voicemail from Elizabeth, who reached out on Facebook to share this praise of Cross-Examine Life.
Hey Chris, it's Elizabeth. So I look at everybody's profile and I actually have a note here to myself, reach out to Chris Tatum, because I loved your profile and I love this idea of elevating the art of disagreement through cross-exam. First of all, it made me think of the debate team, which I could absolutely never be on in high school because I would have lost because I overthink everything. But I think this is so fascinating and I can't wait to check out your podcast. So I just wanted to say hi and I'm super glad to be connected and I can't wait to see what else you've got going on.
Voice messages like this one reaffirm that Cross-Examine Life is filling an important void. It's elevating and improving the way that we disagree with one another and providing a place for thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Elizabeth, thank you so much for leaving that message. And the rest of you listeners out there, I encourage you to drop a note for the show as well. This episode is sponsored by LukeRaffertyVisuals.com. Luke Rafferty is a visual storytelling master. He'll help you take your brand, your product, your message to the next level. If you have an upcoming need for a video or photography project, hit up Luke. Visit him at LukeRaffertyVisuals.com, mention Cross-Examine Life, and get $100 off your first video project. Also, reach out to me. You can leave a message on Facebook, just like Elizabeth did. You can join us, the Cross-Examine Life community, or send me a text or voice message at 307-240-9190. Now let's get to the episode. Here's Nikki, defending the position that the 4,000 individuals walking to the U.S. through Mexico have the right to apply for asylum and have their claims fairly considered on the basis of due process.
So my name is Nikki, and I'm defending the position that the approximately 4,000 individuals who are traveling to the United States in what began as a group which gathered for a Caminata de Migrante, which that roughly translates to a migrant trek, but it's been called by the media the migrant caravan, have the right to apply for the asylum and to have their claims fairly considered on the basis of due process. So my claim is supported by four major arguments, and I'll just go through them quickly and then I'll kind of go into detail. The first is that asylum seekers are guaranteed the right to asylum under U.S. law. The second is that U.S. law does not require asylum seekers to request asylum in another country, including Mexico, before seeking protection in the United States. The third is that for many Central American asylum seekers who make up this Caminata de Migrante, or the caravan, as it's being called, Mexico is not a safe country. And then the fourth is that someone who properly presents themselves at a port of entry in the United States to seek asylum or another type of humanitarian assistance is not breaking any law and should not be treated as such. So just to quickly go back to my first point, that asylum seekers are guaranteed the right to seek asylum under U.S. law, that right is guaranteed under what's called the Refugee Act of 1980, and that put the United States law in line with its obligations to protect refugees under international law, which under international law, we as the United States have the obligation to protection to those who flee persecution on account of five grounds, which are race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. The obligation to provide protection extends to asylum seekers. Those who are seeking protection are entitled to a screening interview, and that determines whether they have a credible fear, and that's the term that's used, of persecution. So basically what happens under current law is if a person shows that they have a credible fear of persecution, they then have the right to apply for asylum and an immigration judge will hear their case. To my second point, that the U.S. law does not require asylum seekers to request asylum in another country before requesting protection in the U.S., that is based on the fact that you don't have to request asylum in a country where you don't feel safe or where you're not safe. The only exception to that rule under U.S. law is where the United States has agreement with another country, and that's called a safe third country agreement. Currently, the U.S. has a safe third country agreement with Canada, which basically means that, for example, if you're seeking asylum and you pass through the United States, you have to apply for asylum in the United States. You can't go all the way through the U.S. and go to Canada. The same applies if you, let's say, landed in Canada or somehow made it to Canada by boat and you arrived on the Canadian shores first, you couldn't then walk through Canada and present yourself at the U.S. border. You would have to apply for asylum in Canada. That's the current law. So to my third point, that for many Central American asylum seekers, Mexico is not a safe country. I just want to point out a little bit of research that's been done. Not to go too extensive into this, and I'm not an expert on this, but there are several groups, including Human Rights First, which is an international human rights organization, that have documented and reported that individuals who are traveling through Mexico to migrate or to seek asylum and assistance, I guess humanitarian assistance, have faced harms that include kidnapping, disappearance, sexual assault, and trafficking. And they've also found that Mexico's asylum system doesn't actually adequately assess their claims, meaning that they have deported individuals who've requested asylum and have valid claims. And then finally, to my last point, someone who properly presents themselves at a port of entry in the United States to seek asylum is not breaking any law and should not be treated as such. The procedure for seeking asylum is showing up and saying, I am being persecuted, I am very afraid, I want asylum. There's really no other way to seek asylum. Asylum is when you run and you seek protection at the place where you're seeking asylum, which is different from refugee processing, which happens in refugee camps and is carried out by the United Nations body, UNHCR, which does refugee processing overseas. And that can take, just as a quick piece of information, that can take 2 to 5 years to process someone and to get them resettled to the country they're seeking refugee from. So if you are threatened and terrified for your family, you're probably not going to wait or look for a refugee resettlement agency. You're probably just going to get out. So in conclusion, just to summarize my point, individuals who are traveling in this large group of asylum seekers who are currently in Mexico have the right to seek asylum in the U.S.
Great. Well, Nikki, I really appreciate you laying out those 4 points and then kind of providing additional information in support of each one. I can't help but jump in here real quick to just comment briefly on Nikki's overall communication strategy in approaching her argument. To provide a context of what she would be talking about, Nikki began by giving 4 different reasons for supporting her broader argument. Then she went back to each one and filled in some details and gave even more specific reasons why each particular argument was valid. Then at the end, she reminded us of the 4 arguments she made. I can't imagine that anyone at this point is unclear about the reasons Nikki has for supporting her argument. So whether you agree or disagree with her, at least she's made herself clear. I think that this is an incredibly effective communication strategy. To first, tell your listeners the broad outline of your argument. To second, fill in details and provide amplifying information for each of the arguments you advance. And finally, to wrap up with restating your original argument points. I think that that was incredibly effective for Nikki, and I think it will be effective for you If that's a strategy you employ the next time you find yourself in a disagreement and in a place where you're trying to both make yourself understood and advance the points underlying your position in the most persuasive way possible. Now let's get to my first question. Well, Nikki, I really appreciate you laying out those 4 points and then kind of providing additional information in support of each one. I thought that I would kick this off with a question from a Cross-Examine Life listener who found out we were going to be talking about this subject and sent in a particular question, which I think goes to your first point about asylum seekers being guaranteed the right to asylum in the first place under U.S. law. And the question was from a very sort of broad perspective of why should someone else's problem in another country become my problem here in America as an American? How do you respond to that?
I think that's a great question. I just want to clarify something because I think you misunderstood my first point. It's not that they have the right to asylum, they have the right to seek asylum. And then once that's processed, the way it works is if a person applies for asylum affirmatively, so if they come to the border and apply for asylum, it will then be heard by an asylum officer. And those are individuals who are trained to assess the veracity of a claim and to look into the information presented to them. And if an asylum officer says, you know what, we're not sure about this, we don't think it is, it's then referred to an immigration judge. People coming and requesting asylum are not automatically guaranteed asylum. They just have the right to request it. And then they'll go through a process of seeking it. Just to make sure that I understand, this person is asking, why do we have the right to kind of look after anybody, or why don't we just protect our own?
This is the first of several times when Nikki clarifies that she is understanding a question properly before providing an answer. I think that's a particularly effective strategy to use in conversation where there might be a disagreement because it prevents you from spending time and energy responding to an issue that's not of primary concern to the two people involved in the conversation. Instead, you can make sure you understand exactly where the point of disagreement lies before actually addressing it. So, props to Nikki for verifying that she understands the question before providing an answer.
Why don't we just protect our own?
Why should we have an obligation to protect someone who's coming from another country? If they're experiencing a problem in their country, why should that become the problem or burden of the United States?
Sure. In this case, the answer is actually pretty simple. It's our law. It's part of the framework of the United States law that we have an asylum process. We've signed international treaties saying that we accept asylum seekers. And so to deny that would go against not only our own laws, but international laws. But on another, I think even more, if we want to talk about the ethics of it or the morals of it, or even the long-term consequences, when we deny asylum seekers, we are sending a message to the world about what our morals are as a country, and also creating problems long term. So if you think about some of the people that we might be sending back, let's say that there are children who are fleeing because of gang violence, maybe mothers or young men who have decided, I don't want to be part of a gang and I want to seek protection. By denying them, we are putting them in situations where they will be in greater danger and actually creating greater humanitarian problems in the future. And so accepting individuals is actually a way to not only show our values, but also it deters the narrative from other countries that the United States doesn't care about people, that they don't care about humanitarian values, which is actually something that terrorist organizations or other organizations, maybe not to use the word terrorist, but organizations that might be a threat to the U.S. can then use in their propaganda against the United States. So I think it's not only a matter of domestic law, but also international security.
But isn't there some risk that we might be creating a greater danger to our own lives as citizens here in the United States by allowing in individuals from foreign countries that have backgrounds we can't really be sure of? They tell a story about their fear of return to their home country, and maybe they're lying. And in fact, they pose a greater danger to us here in the United States. Isn't that a serious concern?
I think that there's always a concern when you let someone into your country or let someone into your house that they're lying to you. But I think the same argument could be applied for someone that we provide a business visa to, or a visa for travel. we live in the 21st century and have fantastic systems of fingerprinting and looking into individuals' backgrounds. We can cross-compare with other countries' systems to look into it. So while I think that there is always a danger, the actual risk, I believe, is quite low. And if you look at statistics of the number of crimes that are committed in the United States by immigrants and by asylum seekers, they are lower than the number of crimes committed by individuals who live in the United States and were born here.
If there's in this group individuals who want to do harm to the United States, wouldn't this be the ideal place to hide, to sort of mix yourself in with a group that maybe some people are telling us we're supposed to have sympathy towards and kind of feel compassion for? And so if you wanted to sneak in to do harm to the United States, wouldn't this be the best way to do that?
I don't think so, actually. I think that particularly because this group of people is saying that they're going to present themselves legally at the border. So unlike other small groups that enter without permission and sneak through and maybe go through mountains or deserts around, this large group, this Caminata de Migrantes, is a group of asylum seekers is actually approaching the border and saying that they're going to seek asylum at the legal ports of entry. And so I think that if you were someone who wanted to do evil deeds, it'd probably be easier to sneak in another direction instead of going through the legal pathway.
So maybe we can set aside the issue of causing harm or intending something violent, but let's just focus on this issue of sort of deception. If you wanted to get asylum in the United States, but you didn't necessarily have something that you legitimately feared in your home country, wouldn't it be easy enough to say, I really fear this particular thing back at home in my home country, and maybe even share a story with someone else in the caravan to sort of hear a compelling story of fear and then just present that at the border to get past, what'd you say, individuals have an interview about if they have a credible fear?
Mm-hmm. So that might work to get in with the credible fear interview, which is it's basically like a 1 in 10 chance if you kind of think of it as percentages. So could people lie and do that to get into the border? Absolutely. I think that the argument that people are going to lie to get into the border is maybe lost in this sense, because I think you could say that about anyone entering into the US. People could come on a tourist visa and say, I'm here for business. People could come and on a performance visa, or they have visas for people with special abilities, like artists and things like that. You could potentially lie on any type of visa. What's different about the asylum system is that once you come in and you say you have a credible fear, it's not just this initial screening. You then go to an interview at the asylum office where you have to present evidence that shows that your well-founded fear is on account of one of those 5 protected grounds that I mentioned. So that's race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. So you have to prove that, and then you have to prove what's called in legal terms a nexus. So you have to say that that persecution that you faced, that the harm that you faced, or the harm that you fear you face, is on account of one of those protected grounds. And then, and this is where it makes asylum pretty difficult, you have to show that either the government is the persecutor, or that they are unable or unwilling to control the persecutor. So it's a pretty difficult thing to claim. And the way that the asylum offices are working currently, you can't just walk in and tell a story. You need to have proof to back it up. And so asylum officers, if you say, I was threatened by this gang, they're going to ask you, well, do you have letters? Do you have emails? Do you have Facebook chats? Do you have somebody in your home country that can attest to that? The burden on the asylum seeker is pretty high in terms of providing this information. And this interview at the asylum office isn't just a quick conversation. These are 2 to 3 to 4 hour interviews with officers who are trained to detect whether people are lying. And I think to get back to your question, could people lie? Absolutely. Could people find a way to work the system? Absolutely. And I think that's the reality of human systems. I think there's a lot of credible evidence that many famous people have figured out ways to get around the tax system and to find loopholes there. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the system shouldn't exist or that we shouldn't try to hold people accountable to the system.
You said that some of these interviews could go 2 and 3 hours long and could be quite extensive to determine if someone should be granted asylum. Did I hear that right?
Mm-hmm.
So if there's 3,000 people in the Caminata de Migrantes that you talked about, and each of them might be entitled to a 3-hour interview, I mean, we're talking 9,000 hours of interviews. That's more than a year's worth of interview hours if you're interviewing 24 hours a day. I mean, that requires tremendous capacity and resources from the United States, doesn't it?
It's actually, if you look at the numbers of asylum seekers who are processed, the average is right around, at least for the latest figures that I was able to find before this interview, which was for March 2018, they were a little over 5,000. So it's actually about 1 month's worth of processing at the asylum office. If you compare those numbers of legally interviewing individuals to the cost of, let's say, sending troops to the border for months and months and months, which news just broke right before our call that there are going to be, I think the number was over 5,000 troops sent to the border. So if you compare those numbers, the numbers of using a humanitarian system to assess the claims of individuals who are walking thousands of miles and have left their homes, I think the cost would be less. I'm not an economist and I don't have all of the figures in front of me. But I think when you consider the cost that way, I don't think the cost is that high.
But asylum claims take months and months and months to get decided, don't they?
They can.
It just seems to me that if you have thousands of these asylum claims that might take months to get decided versus a week or two of sending troops to the border to tell people to turn around, I mean, one seems much more expeditious than the other, no?
I think if you send troops to the border and tell people to turn around, they're going to figure out other ways to come. If you're fleeing for your life, if you have left everything behind because you can't sustain yourself, I mean, when we've seen it happening, there are individuals who've been turned back at the border or been told to wait your turn. There are ports of entry where individuals, and I don't have the specific facts on this right now, but if you do some research, or if your listeners want to do some research, there are individuals at ports of entry who have waited for quite a long time, and they just continue to wait to be kind of to have their turn to go in and say their piece and to have their claim listened to and to enter legally. I think if you tell people to turn around at the border, they're just going to sit and wait.
So the alternative to applying for asylum at a port of entry, you had said before, would be to perhaps get refugee status mm-hmm. in your home country. Is that right?
Yeah. You can try to seek refugee status in your home country or go to a refugee camp and apply for refugee status there.
So why can't these individuals in the Caminata just stay in their home country and apply for refugee status within their country rather than coming to our border and threatening our security?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. The U.S. has really put a cap on the number of refugees that we accept. So in 2017, they put the ceiling for the number of refugees down to 45,000, which is a pretty historically low number. And under the current caps that we have for refugees, the U.S. can only accept 5,000 refugees from Latin America and the Caribbean. And that includes Cuba. So that's a huge area of land. And I think that the numbers of people who are seeking asylum in this group of asylum seekers that are walking to the border shows that there's just not that many refugee visas available.
So it seems like then this is sort of an end run around a limited number of refugee slots. Knowing that they can't get refugee status in their home country, they just depart their home country and show up at a port of entry in the hopes of getting sort of essentially the same benefit at that port of entry that they could have gotten under refugee status if there were more available. Isn't that kind of an end run?
I would argue that most people who are being persecuted don't really look into the law before they go. They probably just up and leave. If you're a young girl and you're told if you don't become a sexual object for this gang, then we will do this by force. I didn't even know what resources you would have if you don't speak English to sincerely investigate the ins and outs of asylum and refugee law, which is already very complicated, to then figure out the proper system to then go to the embassy, which who knows where that would be, how close it is to your hometown, and apply. I think if you're threatened, you probably leave as fast as you can. And so I think that doesn't answer your question, though. I want to be fair to answer your question. Is it a runaround? Could you define runaround? Because I want to make sure that I understand it.
Now I have to interrupt just momentarily to highlight that Nikki just did one of the most effective things you could do in a conversation you're in which you disagree with someone on the opposite side, where you're asked a difficult question. Maybe you're asked a question that causes you to think of lots of different possibilities and answers. And at the end of speaking, you reflect back to the original question and realize maybe you didn't answer the question asked. And so Nikki said, I think that doesn't answer your question, recognizing that what she had just discussed was related to the question, but didn't exactly answer it. And so then she said, I want to be fair to answer your question, which if we're having conversation back and forth and one person is asking questions and another person's providing answers, it seems only fair. I love when she says, could you define an end run? So she wants to actually answer the question. She wants to bring herself back and make sure she addresses it, but she needs a more precise definition before she can provide that complete answer. And so she asks for it. And I'm happy to provide it, as you'll hear next.
Could you define runaround? Because I want to make sure that I understand it.
Yeah, is it, is this just an effort to get the same benefit available under refugee status, sort of more conveniently obtained? So they know that they can't get it in their home country because the limits and the caps are so small. And so they just walk to a port of entry, hoping to get the same benefit that's not really available in their home country because now they're on our doorsteps.
It could be. I think as a human being, I can't really fault another human being for trying to do something the least painful way possible for them. I don't think walking thousands of miles is at all not painful, but if it's the only way you know, or if it's the only way you've heard to do so, then I think it could be what you're saying, the means to get to the same end.
The example that you gave of the girl being sort of forced into sexual servitude with the gang, it was absolutely tragic. But by that example, do you mean to suggest that the majority of individuals in this caminata aren't familiar with asylum law and don't really know what benefits are available to them and are simply walking with the hopes of some sort of good immigration benefit at the U.S. border?
That I don't know. From what I've read about the group of people traveling, it's my understanding that there's a real mixed group in terms of their understanding of what asylum is, in terms of how you apply for asylum, in terms of what they have to do when they get to the U.S. border.
Does it make you any less sympathetic if someone sort of comes here knowing full well kind of what benefits would be available to them and hoping to take advantage of those benefits?
What do you mean when you say less sympathetic?
Maybe less willing to be welcoming and to fling open your doors, because it's not necessarily like someone's just looking for the first safe place that they could possibly find. Instead, it's someone who's sort of making a calculated move to receive a predetermined benefit.
I think that, yes, it definitely puts people who abuse and use the system, put a taint on the system and make the system look less valid. But that does not mean that the law that the United States has on its books and that the international agreements that we have made and that are just moral obligation to help others is any less valid. And so while I think, sure, I mean, if we think about any sort of system, there are always people that will abuse it, but that does not mean that the system shouldn't be in place. And I think it's a risk that you have to take when you're working with humans.
Do you think it's an abuse of the system to make a sort of calculated journey to the United States for a predetermined immigration benefit?
Could you ask that in a different way? I'm working through your question. Actually, can I work through your question out loud?
I have to commend Nikki for yet another fantastic example of a tactic that absolutely improves the way two people disagree. When she wasn't really sure what I was asking, instead of asking me to repeat the question, she instead asked if I could present the question in a different way. And then realizing that she had heard it and just needed to think through it, asked for space to verbally think through it while we spoke. Now, I'm happy to have her do that. I'm happy to know how she is thinking about and processing my questions, and happy to hear her think her way to the answer. So I would just encourage you, the next time you find yourself in a disagreement, to give space, ask for space, take the time to think your way through the question someone else is asking, even if that means doing it out loud, and if you're the one who's asked the question, be generous, be willing to give that space, and be willing to let someone think their way through a question without attacking or making them feel attacked. You'll be surprised at how far you can get in the disagreement, as Nikki and I are about to show you.
Actually, can I work through your question out loud? Because I
go for it.
So you're saying people come to the United States thinking they'll get some sort of immigration benefit, but that immigration benefit could be anything. That immigration benefit could be safety. It could be, I have gangs in my hometown and I know that the U.S. protects its borders and I'm from Honduras and I know that even if I go to Mexico, the gang still has power there. So I wouldn't be safe in Mexico, but I would have the benefit of knowing that my children could sleep safe at night if I get to the United States. So if someone comes on the journey with that predetermined motive to get that benefit, I don't think that there's a problem with it. And I think the number of people who are coming that have a real complex understanding of the immigration system and how to kind of fix it and make up a story and beat the system, it's pretty complex. It's pretty hard to beat it.
But doesn't word get out? I mean, don't people share stories and sort of explain what works and that sort of becomes a reason for motivating people to leave their hometowns and join the caminata?
It could.
It doesn't sound like that especially concerns you.
It doesn't concern me because of my experience of what happens when word spreads, and that is that the story changes, right? So people can have all sorts of understanding of what the law is, how things work, and how you do it. And so I think that's more of a concern, not about the asylum system, but maybe about how the United States shares information about its laws, about the system itself. So, for example, you have the president and other high-ranking individuals sending out tweets saying, don't come to our border. I highly doubt that the asylum seekers who are walking through Mexico are checking tweets from the president on their phone. And so if we're concerned about people applying the right way and understanding the system, then I think the real concern and the real question is, how are we approaching people? So to answer your question, no, it doesn't concern me. What concerns me is how the United States is choosing to disseminate information, which I don't think is effective.
Your second argument was that you shouldn't be required, or as a matter of law in the United States, you're not required to seek asylum in a third country. I think you said where you don't feel safe. Mm-hmm. And you said an exception is where there's a safe third country agreement. Like if you're going to Canada and you pass through the U.S., you would have to apply for asylum in the U.S. before you got to Canada. Did mm-hmm. I get that part right?
Yep.
All right. So this sort of standard of not feeling safe, isn't that really subjective? I mean, for someone to kind of pass through Mexico and say, well, I don't feel safe, it's sort of leaving a lot of discretion in the hands of the person doing the walking, isn't it?
Well, that's why we have the Safe Third Country Agreement. So there is actual information from various human rights groups that have looked into the situation and have provided reports that show Mexico is not a safe third country for various reasons. There's violence, there's stories of individuals who have fled from their home country in Central America to Mexico only to be kidnapped or murdered prominent example is there's a journalist, Edwin Rivera, and he fled threats from Honduras. He went to Mexico and he was murdered in Veracruz, Mexico. And obviously this is just one example, but there are many stories that have been documented by groups showing that Mexico is not a safe third country. So to answer your question about whether it's subjective, yes, it's subjective in the fact that a person will decide that they don't feel safe. So for example, this group of asylum seekers that started off, they started the number about a week ago was 7,000. And now the numbers that we're seeing is around 3,000 to 4,000 because there were a group of people who decided we do feel safe and want to apply for asylum in Mexico. And my argument is not that they shouldn't or they can't, but they are not required to. So if they don't feel safe, if they're fleeing a gang and they feel like the gang has influence in Mexico, they don't have to stay in Mexico. They can continue on to the United States. And until the United States signs a safe third country agreement with Mexico, which would be in contradiction to a lot of these studies that have shown that Mexico is not a safe third country because of kidnapping, because of individuals being held for ransom money, because of the violence that has been documented there by NGOs like Doctors Without Borders, Human Rights Watch, then I think that even though it's subjective, it follows the standards that we've set up.
I want to come back just for a moment to this question of resources. And when I asked you about that before, you seemed to suggest that it wasn't significantly more than normal for a typical month. Did I hear that correctly? Or maybe if you could say a little more about that?
Sure. So the numbers that I was referring to were the numbers of asylum claims that are considered at the asylum offices around the United States per month. And that number, the latest number that I could find quickly before our chat was from March 2018. And that number, I can find it again, but I didn't write it down, but it was a little bit over 5,000. And so that was interesting to me because that was actually less than the number of people who are in this group. And who knows how many people of this group who are walking through Mexico and still have at least 1,000 or 2,000 miles left to walk. Who knows how many of them will actually decide to apply at the border. Some may get tired and turn back, but to answer your question, that's what I meant by the average number.
Yeah.
Did I answer your question?
Well, I guess maybe my question is, I don't know if I was very clear about it, so I'll sort of frame it this way. It's still an increase of, say, the 3,000 people in the group, you know, did apply for asylum, and your position is that we have an obligation to process those claims. That's still an increase of sort of 3,000 beyond the norm that we would typically see in a month, right?
It could be, yeah.
I mean, isn't that just an enormous burden on the system and an additional expense that someone has to bear the brunt of?
I think, yes, it adds a burden to the system. Yes, it's an expense. But when we consider the alternatives, I think it's the best alternative. And I'm not an economist, but it seems like it's the least expensive option. So if you look at the other options that we've got, I mean, one option is this sending, you know, building a wall. I haven't seen the latest wall figures, but the ones that I had seen previously were pretty high. I haven't seen the figures on how much it costs to keep 5,200 troops at the border for months, but I'm assuming that that is also pretty high. And so if you think about 1 month of, let's round up and let's say that the number of claims you get is equivalent to 1 month of paying asylum officers, that still seems less than the cost of the wall or the cost of maintaining troops at the border. And I think that the humanitarian risks are a lot lower. So what I mean by that is the risk of having armed troops on the border is that you might, because you're tired, because you see something wrong, because it's Christmas and you want to be with your family and you're just a little bit, you've got some anger pent up, you might harm someone or someone might harm you. I think to be fair, someone might harm you. But I think that the chances of someone who's armed harming someone who's unarmed is possible. I think that the idea of building a border wall, if you look at sections of the wall that we have right now, walls fall down. There's sections of the wall where there's just gaping holes underneath them because they were built in places where the land is not that stable. There's ecological challenges to building a wall and separating roots of various types of flora and fauna. And so if we think about, yes, there's a cost. I don't disagree with you that there's a cost and there's a burden. But if we think about what is the option that has the lowest humanitarian, ecological, and even world standing cost, I think adjudicating these asylum claims is the best option.
Okay. You had said previously that there's a limit or a cap on the number of refugee statuses granted each year.
Mm-hmm.
Is there also a cap on the number of asylum applications either reviewed or granted each year?
Nope, not right now.
Do you think there should be a cap?
I don't, because I think that puts our country at a risk of what happens if the next Holocaust happens. And we turn away people who will literally be turned back to die because we say, oh, well, we reached our cap. I just don't think it's wise from a humanitarian's perspective.
I do give all my guests the opportunity to indicate at the end of these cross-examinations whether or not their perspective has changed in any way as a result of this back and forth. And so I just wanted to kick it to you to see if the way that you think about this has changed in any way.
I don't think the way that I think about this has changed anyway. I really appreciate the questions that you asked. I think that this could be a much longer discussion, and I hope that your Facebook group continue to talk about it. I think it's really complicated, and I think that a lot of the issues that we're seeing now and the reason that people are fleeing from Central America might and probably do have to do with previous decisions by other U.S. administrations. And so I think that there's no easy answer to this question, but I do think that we have laws and international agreements and we should stick by them. It's going to be complicated and messy, but conversations where we dive into the messy are really important for that.
Well, Nikki, I can't thank you enough for coming on Cross Examine Life to discuss what you, I think, accurately said is a very tricky and challenging topic. So thank you very much.
Yeah, no, thank you, Chris.
Now it's time for Practical Takeaway Tips, the part of the show where you get practical tips you can use the next time you find yourself in the midst of a disagreement. Tip number one, when presenting your position, give your audience a broad outline of your various points and then go back and fill in the details underlying each point. Finally, remind the audience what you told them. Second tip, make sure you understand the question well, clarifying if necessary, before you provide an answer. Tip number three, after you answer, check in with your recollection to make sure that you answered the question that was asked. If you didn't, admit that you didn't answer the question, and then tackle it head on. If needed, ask for further clarification before answering it. Tip number four, ask for space to think through a question. And if someone asks for that space, without criticism, give them space to think through your question or the issue presented out loud. You saw what a better conversation that led to when Nikki and I did exactly that. So what'd you think of today's cross-exam? Join our Facebook group, the Cross-Examine Life Community, to let other listeners know. There, you can find a summary of Nikki's argument and an ongoing discussion about whether or not she proved her point. Well, that'll about do it for today's cross-exams. If you enjoyed them, please leave us a rating in the iTunes store and mention this show next time you're swapping podcast recommendations with friends.
Thanks so much for listening. If you liked what we're doing here, find more of our questions on iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to propose a topic or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at crossexaminedlife.com.